This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day, and we're analyzing President Barack Obama's State of the Union address. Political science professors Donna Hoffman from the University of Northern Iowa and Iowa State University's Stefan Schmidt will be commenting on what they saw and heard, as well as the political nuances that'll be determining how the president's speech achieves his long-range objectives and how those objectives might be affecting Iowans. Politics Day with Stefan Schmidt and Donna Hoffman, River to River, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg with River to River, and today is Politics Day. We have Donna Hoffman in our Cedar Falls studio. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Dean. How are you?
Donna is political science chair at the University of Northern Iowa. And Stefan Schmidt in our Ames studio. Hello, Stefan.
Hi, Dean and Donna.
And he's a professor of political science at Iowa State University. Well, let's get to the news of the day and the news of last night right away. Stefan, starting out with you, the ambiance and the political theater of the State of the Union address, how do you view that? How has that evolved over the years?
Well, the problem last night was, frankly, that the news of the day was a police, gun battle with a murderer. It was a dog show. It was the expectation about Marco Rubio and Rand Paul giving his speech, and it was Mardi Gras. So I don't know what the ratings were last night, but good grief, most Americans were probably watching one of those things. So when the few who did watch it, including the three of us, saw the usual pomp and circumstance, I think I wrote in my op-ed piece that's coming out tomorrow in the Des Moines Register that I sensed sort of that there was a little less acid and a little more cordiality in the room. Nobody shouted, "You lie," to the president.
No.
And there were actually Democrats and Republicans standing next to each other, which is something we haven't seen for a while. So as far as that was concerned, I thought it was at least a hopeful sign that there might be a few issues on which the two parties can negotiate and come up with some successful legislative results.
Donna, did you see it too, though, that it's taken on the aura, at least as I view it, almost like a political campaign rally?
Well, it's always been, since it's been orally delivered, since Wilson restarted that tradition in 1913, you've always had the occasion of the president coming to the chamber, another branch of Congress. So there's always this measure of pomp and circumstance to it. This speech, though, Lyndon Johnson wisely, at least for the president, moved the delivery of the speech to primetime television hours in 1965 because he could see that, you could take advantage of this. And so the public then very clearly became an audience to this speech. It's not just the president saying to Congress, here's what I want you to do, here's what I'd like you to do. He's saying this while he knows the public is watching. And so he will say things, that we know probably won't pass Congress, but he wants to get the public in on that particular conversation.
And
that's been a constant.
I'm glad you said that, Donna, because, even as I view it, even the audience has a role in playing to a national television audience in, first of all, generating energy for the speaker,
mm-hmm.
and then showing approval or disapproval by either standing, clapping, or not.
Right. And, you can always see the Speaker of the House and the Vice President behind the President. And, people read their body language. And, there's already been a lot of commentary on Boehner not standing up at certain times. Joe Biden gleefully doing various things that Joe Biden does. And if you're in the audience, you're a member of Congress in the audience, you have to understand that at any time a camera might be be focused on you. If you watched when Obama called out John McCain and mentioned him by name in the speech, the camera went to John McCain and he had this very, very uncomfortable smile on his face. And, you know, I saw our own Senator Chuck Grassley at one point. The cameras went to him. You know, you don't want to be caught texting on your phone or sleeping or yawning or any of those kinds of things. So the congressional members of the audience know that the seesaw, as we might call it, who stands up, who sits down, who's sitting next to who, those kinds of things are all things that people will watch and people will comment on usually.
And Stephen, special guests also, I don't want to belittle their presence there, but they also are props, important props in the president's speech, and they personify points that he wants to make.
Well, the whole event is a staged event, very carefully prepared. People pick ties that they think they want, you know, the audience to see, their colleagues to see. And Ronald Reagan, I think, did a great job in bringing in soldiers and war heroes and all kinds of other people and having them up in the gallery. The spouse of the president is usually the host of that. And those folks add a tremendous personal and emotional touch to what is otherwise a little bit of a wonkish event. And last night, I don't know if Donna agrees with me or not, the actual high point and most moving part of the State of the Union address was the end when Obama started talking about gun control, that Congress needed to vote. And he called out and shouted out the folks who have had tragic experiences with gun violence who were with Mrs. Obama. And it was a touching moment that even John Boehner had to stand up and applaud and look as though he agreed.
Well, just as you have said, let's listen to that.
Idea's parents, Nate and Cleo, are in this chamber tonight, along with more than two dozen Americans whose lives have been torn apart by gun violence. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
Donna, does that emotion help ensure what the president is calling for, a vote on his gun control proposals?
Well, I think, you know, he's repeating that phrase and people are responding to that, and it very much makes that memorable. I mean, we can look back to, you know, Clinton had a phrase similar to that, although he didn't repeat it over and over, when he talked about saving Social Security first. So occasionally there are those kinds of phrases, and the president, you know, in saying they deserve a vote is really not asking for much. You know, he said earlier in the speech, you know, you can vote no if you'd like, but, you know, don't bury it under procedural problems and, you know, get it out to a vote. And really what he's trying to convey there is that, and if you listen to what he said earlier, you know, that the public does approve of things like universal background checks. And so he's trying to involve the public on that conversation. And if there's I think the idea here is if there's a vote in Congress, the public would be somewhat involved in that, and that might change the way that Congress would go about looking at these various things. If they bury it under procedural things and it never gets to a vote, the public is less involved in that conversation.
And Stephen, it plays differently in different parts of the country. How about Iowa? How would that play in Iowa as compared to Texas?
Well, Iowa is the most difficult state in the country because we are so divided. We have a very, very liberal senator, and we have a very conservative senator. We have, you know, equally two Republican, two Democrats in the House. It's a state where it'll play very strongly to half of the state.
Did we lose Stephen Schmidt?
Nope. I said half the state.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, you know, the problem is this country is deeply divided over this issue. And Iowa is deeply divided. And I think in Texas even, you know, certainly law enforcement officers and others are not entirely happy with the fact that we have allowed our gun ownership, gun sales, gun purchases, and so on to become as permissive as it is. It's always been permissive, but... You know, more and more, those folks are concerned, you know, if there is a heavily armed citizenry out there, and a lot of those citizens view their gun ownership not as hunting or protecting their home. They view it and they say that they want to own very ominous guns and formidable guns because they may have to use them against an oppressive government. That makes the hair stand up on the neck of law enforcement officials. And what happened in California just this past 24 hours certainly gives pause for us to think about those things. So I think Obama probably connected with a lot of people, but to be honest with you, I don't think Congress is going to move very much on gun control, period.
Well, it certainly is generating a lot of emotion on both sides around the country. And Donna, in just a moment, I'm going to ask you, if it doesn't happen now, how likely it is that we're going to see another gun control debate with all the momentum that the president was generating in emotion last night. But before you answer that, just a personal observation. In Little Mount Vernon, Iowa, just outside Cedar Rapids, I saw that personally over the weekend. The mayor of Mount Vernon called for just a open forum at the city hall on what to do, if anything, about guns, and just let people vent their opinions on gun safety and so on. There were so many vehicles on Main Street and clogging the parking lot that lots around town, you couldn't get through the town hardly, and the city council chambers overflowing out into the hallway. And so that kind of emotion is being generated around the country. So the question is, if not now, ever?
You know, I think, you know, this is a good point. This is a very, as Stephen said, this is a very divisive issue, and it is a very emotional issue, and people connect with this issue very emotionally. But you do have an interesting feature in this particular debate after Newtown, in that the debate has been a little bit prolonged. So oftentimes when a mass shooting event happens, we see in media stories and various things, people have, you know, charted this and looking at the reporting, it drops off. And it hasn't done that after Newtown. And I think qualitatively that event was a bit different because of the nature of the victims. They were, you know, first graders. And so I do think we will have a debate in Congress. And I do think we will have a conversation about this nationally. That does not mean that we will necessarily get any successful legislation out of that. But I think the time is better now than it has been for a very long period of time. And let us not forget that, in the 90s and even into the 2000s, we did have an assault weapons ban and a magazine capacity ban that was in effect for a 10-year period, and then it lapsed. And so, you know, things that would need to happen, you know, if the NRA goes back to previous positions that they took, for example, on background checks, that might move something. And so it'll be kind of interesting, I think, to see how the debate goes forward. But I do think we will have the debate. Now, whether we actually get any legislation out of that would pass is a different story. But, you know, a precursor to getting any action is, in fact, to have a debate first.
Well, I think we're going to have a debate on most of the issues that Obama talked about last night, including minimum wage increases, including immigration reform, including global climate change and so on. But in the end, I'm very pessimistic that it'll be more than debate, that, you know, it may come up in the floor, the House leadership may allow it to actually come up for debate or send it to committee at least. But I don't have, you know, very, very much hope that any of those things are actually going to produce legislation. The National Rifle Association in 2013 is nothing like it was the last time the assault weapons ban was enacted. It has become extremely wealthy, extremely powerful. And it has retreated from all of the positions that it had on things even like guns in schools, where Wayne LaPierre, the last time he talked about this issue, said absolutely no guns in any schools in this country. And the latest position of the NRA is, you know, armed individuals, volunteers or others with firearms in every school in the country. So this is a different America that we're living in now.
That's right. You mentioned immigration and minimum wage and so on. Let's go to immigration right now. Let's listen to what the president said. And he was, in this instance, he drew bipartisan support. There was a standing ovation when he got to immigration.
Our economy is stronger when we harness the talents and ingenuity of striving, hopeful immigrants. And right now, leaders from the business, labor, law enforcement, faith communities, they all agree that the time has come to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now's the time to do it. Now's the time to get it done. Now's the time to get it done.
Well, Donna, he said now's the time to get it done. Is that train leaving the station? And what could possibly at this point derail progress on that issue?
Oh, most anything could derail progress on that issue, I think. I agree with Stefan in that I think the moving of gun control legislation is probably unlikely. But immigration, there's a little bit more of a glimmer of hope, I think, on that something could move. There have been some bipartisan efforts to write some things. There have been bipartisan efforts before. And so I think that we might see something there. But again, it's still very difficult to move that. But, you know, again, we have to have this conversation. And so it'll be interesting to see. I think it's more likely that we'll get something in terms of immigration reform, because that's more likely to also be somewhat bipartisan.
But is that also, Stefan, being moved by the last election and the Hispanic vote there, which went Democratic?
Yes, it is. But frankly, I don't think there's going to be immigration reform passed that has... Let me explain it. I gave a lecture this morning on it. The Republicans want to pass something called immigration reform. It consists primarily of saying, first of all, we'll pass it, and eventually there'll be some sort of decriminalization of the 11 million who are in this country. They may have to go home first and then get in line to come back in here. But first, we are going to have to secure our borders and have to secure the visas of people who come to this country to make sure that they, when they come on a tourist or student visa, they actually leave again. So that's we do that first before we start talking about normalizing the lives of the 11 million or whatever they are who are here. And the Democrats and Obama are not going to go for that at all. I mean, the Democrats and Obama are saying, well, when is that going to happen? Who is going to certify that the borders are secure? When are we going to put in place a realistic system for entry and exit, you know, a check in and check out like you would with a DVD at a rental store?
Stefan?
It's going to take forever, and the Democrats, I think, in some respects at least, don't want to take the immigration issue off the table, because that has been the great weakness of the Republicans vis-a-vis the Hispanic and Latino voter. And if they pass a bill that is called immigration reform, the Republicans will be able to say, see, we supported immigration reform and we want our Hispanic and Latino friends, you know, to have their lives normalized. And if it's a phony bill, if it's a bill that doesn't really do immigration reform, it simply depoliticizes it and gives the Republicans the victory.
Stefan,
I'm very cynical about it.
But Mitch is calling from Des Moines, wants to ask you a question about immigration. Let's take Mitch's call. Go ahead, Mitch.
Well, I think with the immigration wave, I mean, I feel real positive on a national level, especially in the U.S. Senate. I'm not sure what's going to happen in the Congress. Got a lot more conservative Republicans there, and it's probably less of a possibility. But if you look at Iowa, I think with 2 weeks ago, Senate Democrats introduced legislation for the DREAM Act, the Iowa version, where young Latinos under the age of 30 can attend colleges or universities here in the state of Iowa and pay in-state tuition versus out-of-state tuition. I mean, does Dr. Schmidt think something like that, I mean, more on a statewide level, would be more of a possibility than what's happened nationally?
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I have, in fact, I talked about it the other day. a lot. In fact, I talked about it this morning because we covered the State of the Union in my American government class. There are a lot of states, New Mexico, for example, and others, where the state is actually issuing driver's license to people who are undocumented and saying, we've got to get them out of the shadow and let them at least live a sort of semi-normal life until we can move further and complete the decriminalization and so on. So a lot of states are looking at ways of essentially dealing with this problem.
Well,
only problem is that some of the states, like Georgia and others, are not going that direction. They're going in Arizona. They're going in the direction of essentially stopping anyone who looks brown and potentially illegal and having the police have the authority to check their papers. And that's, number one, that's not immigration reform. It's the opposite. And secondly, it is certainly not going to help the Republicans much with Latino voters if that continues.
Stefan, let's quickly go, and Donna, quickly go to climate change and see what the president said on that last night.
It's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 50. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late.
You know, the president also mentioned that, probably gave the most time of any subject in his inaugural address to climate change, Donna. And he says here also last, he promised that he would act if Congress doesn't through executive order. What's within his power to do that?
Well, you know, we've seen, and this was much remarked upon in the inaugural address, that he was much more forceful and did devote more attention to climate change than he had previously. We see it, you know, again in this particular speech in the State of the Union. One of the things the president potentially can do because of a Supreme Court decision, the EPA could regulate carbon emissions, and that's really what's at issue here. And so he's, you know, essentially using a threat here to Congress. Look, if you don't want to do cap, I mean, he's essentially talking about some form of cap and trade. He talks about a market-based regulation kind of system. And, you know, he's essentially saying to Congress, look, if you guys don't want to do this by legislation, I do, in fact, have some authority to do this through executive order because the Supreme Court has held that the EPA can, in fact, regulate carbon emissions. And so, you know, executive orders are nice for a president in one sense in that they're immediate, but they aren't permanent. And another president can come in and erase those once they're there. The other thing is that you could have Congress write legislation that then would affect that. The court could come in and look at those. But those things take time. So, you know, I think the president genuinely wants legislation here because once you do that, that is there. But he's willing to settle, I think, for an executive order. But in addition, he's also using that kind of as a threat to Congress. Look, act. And this is the point at which he, you know, also talks about bipartisan solutions that previously had been submitted by Lieberman and McCain. So he's also trying to, you know, pressure some bipartisan action on that.
Sure. Stefan, just quickly before we hit the break here, does he have to worry about approval ratings if he acts unilaterally?
Well, not if it's marginal things that, you know, don't really make any difference. I mean, those are all working on the margins of climate change. There are 1,199 coal-fired plants on the books to be built around the world, most of them in China and India. What is U.S. Climate change regulation going to do to that?
Thank you. We're going to hear more, and we've got plenty for you in the next half hour. Take a quick break now. If you'd like to call and join the conversation, it's 866-780-9100. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Dean Borg continuing River to River on Iowa Public Radio, and we have a lively discussion going here with Donna Hoffman, who is the political science chair at the University of Northern Iowa. She's in our studio in Cedar Falls, and over in our Ames studio, Stefan Schmidt, who's a professor of political science at Iowa State University. Of course, we're dissecting the State of the Union. I started to say condition, and that's the condition of the state, but the State of the Union. delivered by President Obama last night. And we're also going to hear from Florida Senator Marco Rubio in just a little bit. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 866-780-9100, but we're going to be moving quickly because we've got a lot to cover. And just let me ask, Stefan, what didn't we hear last night that you would have expected or liked to have heard or didn't expect to hear because it wasn't politically correct?
Well, actually, to be honest with you, I thought this was a sort of comprehensive menu. There was very little on foreign policy, and that, I think, is conforms to our conclusion that Obama plans really to retreat, that he plans to pull back, that he announced that, you know, we're bringing back our troops quicker than normal. He didn't really want to get into, you know, many of the hot, explosive areas of the world very deeply. Because this next 4 years is going to be a domestic policy administration. I mean, there is a lot of buzz and evidence from lots of people that Obama really wants to concentrate on domestic issues. And I think the speech sort of reflected that.
Well, Donna, I was going to ask you what you didn't hear last night, but Stefan and I will bring up in just a moment. I'll let you respond to that. But I want to go quickly then, because Stefan says this is going to be a domestic issue. I want to go to the minimum wage. But what didn't you hear last night? I'll give you a chance.
You know, one of the things that was interesting that we didn't hear, and it does relate to foreign policy, is that this was the first State of the Union address in a long time that did not contain the word Iraq in it. And so while it's not necessarily so that we would expect it, because that engagement has very significantly winded down, it was notable in that this is the first time that wasn't in a State of the Union address for quite some time.
Well, say, there wasn't yesterday, Stefan was mentioning all the other distractions that in the news cycle that were happening yesterday. Also, North Korea with that nuclear test.
Yes, and you know, that did get a brief mention, although it wasn't really direct in the speech. But, you know, North Korea did get a brief mention in the foreign policy section. But, you know, these speeches really aren't about foreign policy. I mean, if we look at these historically, foreign policy, while you can have some years where foreign policy is somewhat prominent, by and large, the historical record here is that foreign policy pretty much always takes a backseat to domestic policy. And that's because of the nature of the audiences. The public is here. Congress is here. Both of those audiences care most about domestic policy. Now, interestingly enough, you know, we may find, in fact, Obama does focus on foreign policy at some point in the second term of his presidency because he has more ability to act there without other people impinging on things than he does in domestic policy. And, you know, one of the themes we often see in second term presidencies is that at some point they turn to foreign policy because they have a freer hand there.
Well, foreign policy is a loser proposition in the world we live in now. What are we going to do, invade North Korea and bomb Iran, you know? I mean, and what are we going to do in places like Syria, where Obama deliberately has sort of kept hands off? I mean, that's a real sticky situation. I think Obama is smart enough to know that he might be able to get more traction and come out in the history books a little better if he sort of concentrates on rebuilding the economy, getting growth going, do some of those things. I don't know. That's my opinion anyway.
Well, I would say, though, that, you know, presidents do get sucked into that. Especially in the Middle East, I can solve the Middle East problem. I'll broker a deal between Israel and and the Palestinians. Yeah. And you oftentimes see presidents think that because they want to have a lasting legacy, not just in domestic policy, but in foreign policy too. They sometimes turn to those events, you know, in the last couple of years to try to make some kind of lasting thing. You know, especially Clinton tried to do that as well. So,
well, the middle class has been a byword here for the past several months in the campaign and again last night as it relates to the minimum wage.
Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. We should be able to get that done. This single step would raise the incomes of millions of working families. It could mean the difference between groceries or the food bank, rent or eviction, scraping by or finally getting ahead. For businesses across the country, it would mean customers with more money in their pockets. And a whole lot of folks out there would probably need less help from government. In fact, working folks shouldn't have to wait year after year for the minimum wage to go up while CEO pay has never been higher. So here's an idea that Governor Romney and I actually agreed on last year. Let's tie the minimum wage to the cost of living so that it finally becomes a wage you can live on.
Donna, is that right? Mitt Romney was calling also for an increase in the minimum wage?
Well, that's not what he said. What Obama said right there. He said that Mitt Romney and I agreed on tying minimum wage to the cost of living. So there's actually two things there. We could raise the minimum wage and leave it at that. Or we could raise the minimum wage and tie it to the cost of living. Or we could keep the minimum wage where it is right now and then tie it to the cost of living, and then it automatically just goes up. So there's actually a couple of different things there.
I'm glad you clarified that, because just on listening to it casually, I think most people would have thought Governor Romney was also calling for an increase in the minimum wage.
And I don't think, you'd have to check me on that, I don't think that was what he was on record for saying. He was on record for saying, and if you listen to Obama, I think that's what he was referring to, as saying that maybe it should be tied to cost of living so that we wouldn't have to, through congressional action every once in a while, have a debate, but you would just have it automatically go up.
And the key players, namely the Republicans in the House, didn't buy any of that anyway. So, you know, that... I mean, it was clear from Marco Rubio, and it's even more clear from Rand Paul, that, you know, the Republicans are opposed to the minimum wage. They're not opposed to increasing the minimum wage, that's for sure, but they're opposed to the minimum wage. They want market forces to determine what people make,
and
supply
that
and demand.
And that minimum wage right now is $7.25, last raised as I have it in 2009?
Yeah, that's what it is. I asked my class this morning, and you know, half the class raised their hands saying no, they thought the market should do it. We really believe that market forces can determine prices of things, you know, whether it's gasoline or hamburgers or wages. And so I don't think that the minimum wage increase is going to go anywhere in the House, frankly. The only time most of the things he talked about last night might really get some traction in the House is after 2014, if the Democrats regain control of the House. And by then they will have lost the Senate. So then, you know, the discussion will be different from now.
You mentioned Marco Rubio, the Republican senator from Florida, and Kentucky Senator Rand Paul giving the Tea Party response, and Senator Rubio giving the response for the Republican Party. What's the significance of two replies, Donna?
Well, this isn't the first time we've seen this. Michelle Bachmann did a Tea Party response a couple of years ago, I believe it was. And, you know, it signals one of the problems the GOP has had to deal with in the last several years, in that there's a schism within the party. There's the Tea Party wing, there's the more establishment wing, and it's not really clear if they're going to come back together. You know, the person who is picked to do the response to the president's State of the Union is oftentimes going to be someone that the party sees as a rising star. And that certainly, when we saw Bobby Jindal do this a few years ago, and it actually wasn't a very good response, but we saw Marco Rubio. He's, you know, seen as kind of being one of those people within the Republican Party who's a rising star. But you do have Rand Paul, who gave the Tea Party response. And, you know, that did not receive a lot of coverage. As a matter of fact, I haven't even been able to see it yet. And but nevertheless, it was put out there that he was doing this. And, the GOP response was not good enough for the Tea Party faction of the party. And so they want to carve up out their own territory.
And, the fact that Rand Paul wasn't covered even by Fox really, really ticked off the Tea Party, because I was reading blogs this morning and tweets. Boy, are they angry. And that means that Rand Paul got what he needed. He doesn't care about you and me. He cares about recharging the Ron Paul base of the Libertarian Tea Party wing of the party. And by not covering the speech, I think he got that accomplished.
And Senator Rubio, as he spoke last night, criticized the president's policy proposals and the tactic of the president, as Senator Rubio would say it, of casting those who oppose him, that is the president, as people who support only the rich.
Mr. President, I still live in the same working-class neighborhood I grew up in. My neighbors aren't millionaires. They're retirees who depend on Social Security and Medicare. They're workers who have to get up early tomorrow morning and go to work to pay the bills. They're immigrants who came here because they were stuck in poverty in the countries where the government dominated the economy. The tax increases and the deficit spending you propose will hurt middle-class families. It will cost them their raises. It will cost them their benefits. It may even cost some of them their jobs. And it will hurt seniors because it does nothing to save Medicare and Social Security. So, Mr. President, I don't oppose your plans because I want to protect the rich. I oppose your plans because I want to protect my neighbors.
Overall, Stefan, how effective did you think Senator Rubio's response was? And, see, he lacked all the trappings that the president had of being in the House chamber and the applause and so on like that. Even had to do a sidestep there to get a sip of water at one point. Give me an assessment.
He did a nice job. You know, the ratings, I was just Googling it, and the ratings for this State of the Union were down again. People are not watching it very much. People have so many options now. You know, they don't have to watch any of the cable news channels, and they certainly don't have to watch the networks. And so a lot of people watch what they really want to watch, and Americans are not that interested in this sort of stuff. So Marco Rubio did a nice job laying out the Republican establishment position on issues. And he certainly is going to be the front runner for president. Rand Paul is going to run for president in 2016 unless something drastic happens. So no doubt what we saw, as again I said in my article in the Register, the opening of the Iowa caucus and primary season for 2016 last night with those two giving the essentially the response to Obama's speech. And that was an interesting thing.
Don?
I think Rubio did a nice job. You know, this is a really difficult speech to give, and it's being contrasted with the president's speech. You don't have an audience. If you remember back to Bobby Jindal's speech a few years ago, it was very awkward, and part of that was the staging, but he didn't have an audience. Rubio surmounted those problems that Jindal had. You know, unfortunately, though, we still see, and you even referred to this, Dean, you know, he reached off to the side and got a bottle of water, and that probably got more attention than anything that he actually said content-wise in his speech. But this is a very difficult speech for people to give because of the lack of audience, the lack of reaction, and you feed off of those things when you are giving a speech to an audience.
That's right.
And so it's a very difficult thing to do. And so I think he did a really good job in that regard. But unfortunately, I don't think people paid a lot of attention to his content.
The president and Senator Rubio both did a lot of time talking about the economy. The president asserting that his plans for new spending would not add to the deficit.
Tonight I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat, nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime. It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth.
Stefan, how likely is it that he's going to get new revenue or a tax increase through that Republican-controlled House?
About as likely as a golden retriever winning the dog show, which is zero.
You had that one ready.
Yeah, well, you know, that everybody's complaining that it's always these nasty little dogs that win and none of the big hunting dogs and so on. So the Westminster Dog Show needs to, you know, eventually be a little more generous with hunting dogs. But I don't think it's very likely. The Republicans have already given in. You know, they say the tax issue is behind us. We want to close loopholes, but they don't say which loopholes. And I guess if the Democrats and Republicans could agree on loopholes to close, those would be mostly not middle-class loopholes, because don't even think about taking away my homeowner deduction on interest mortgages, because you'll have a revolution on your hands. So it's probably mostly rich people's deductions on capital gains and other things. And they might tweak a little bit there, but you got to understand this. The Republicans and the Democrats have a completely different economic framework which they see as the best for the country. And one of them involves cutting spending and cutting taxes and shrinking government and unleashing capitalism and entrepreneurship. The other one, Obama's, is that the government is an agent of good and to raise people's standard of living and educate kids and, you know, create opportunities for immigrants and so on, all of which cost a lot of money, and therefore you've got to raise revenue somewhere. And if Obama wants any of his things to be implemented, he's got to go find revenue. I think it's baloney that this is revenue neutral. I mean, it just can't be. Even giving 11 million undocumented people in this country citizenship, I saw a statistical study the other day, will create an enormous economic burden on especially states with large numbers of these immigrants. And even the federal government, because they suddenly become American residents and therefore entitled to a lot of programs that they now are kept out of. And so that's going to be an enormous expense, even just that.
Donna, yeah, I was watching. You know, go ahead.
I just wanted to add there, you know, this speech wasn't necessarily about getting things through Congress. A lot of this speech was focused on 2014. Obama doesn't think he's going to get an increase in the minimum wage, but he can say, I want to increase the minimum wage. I want to, you know, balance things out. I want to, you know, equal tax revenues and spending cuts. And he's not going to get those things. And he knows he's not going to get those things. But he can say in the run up to the midterm elections, look, here are the things we as Democrats have wanted to do. And the Republicans in the House of Representatives in particular, and, you know, partially in the Senate, with the filibuster, have stymied us on those. So why don't you send Democrats to Congress and then we can actually get these things done? So, you know, a lot of the things that go in this speech are not actually about, hey, Congress, why don't you do this? It's about talking to the public and saying, this is really what I want. But look, Congress is being, you know, is stymieing me here and you should help me out.
It's true, but it's not clear that actually for 2014 that is going to be a winning argument, because the Republicans are going to come back and say, he's bankrupting our country even more. He would like to really drive it into the ground. And what are our grandchildren going to do? How are they ever going to pay this off? Because the Republicans have done very well with their fiscal conservative arguments. They have won elections, governorships, and state legislatures, and they control the House still. So it's not clear that, in fact, that will increase the turnout for Democrats in 2014, I think, at least. I mean, we can argue that.
It may not be a winning argument, but I think it's the argument the Democrats are going to make.
Just quickly, Donna, George Will, in analysis last night after the speech, called it disingenuous about not adding new spending. The president's claim about not adding new spending.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the devil is in the details. There's lots of ways to cut the budget, and key with budgetary things, you know, like the, with especially with the sequester, with the Budget and Accounting Act, and various things that the president was at least referring to without talking about them in those terms that the Americans don't understand, is that these things are complex, and there's a lot of ways to look at these things. And, you know, politicians rely on the fact that these things are complex, and the American public doesn't really delve into these. As, you know, Stefan mentioned earlier, the American public's not paying a heck of a lot of attention to politics at this point. And that's really kind of unfortunate, but it's actually very unfortunate. But politicians, in some respect, do count on the fact that a good portion of Americans are disengaged.
But they are paying attention to entitlement programs. And the president referred to that last night as he inferred that nothing is going to be done to change the entitlement programs, such as Medicare. He called it keeping a promise that's been made to Americans. And then Senator Rubio also addressed Medicare in his response, saying Congress needs to balance its budget.
The biggest obstacle to balancing the budget are programs where spending is already locked in. One of these programs is Medicare. It's especially important to me. It provided my father the care he needed to battle cancer and ultimately to die with dignity. And it pays for the care my mother receives right now. I would never support any changes to Medicare that would hurt seniors like my mother. But anyone who's in favor of leaving Medicare exactly the way it is right now is in favor of bankrupting it. Republicans have offered a detailed, incredible plan that helps save Medicare without hurting today's retirees. Instead of playing politics with Medicare, when is the president going to offer his detailed plan to save it? Tonight would have been a good time for him to do it.
Well, Donna, that sets up the impasse, doesn't it?
Well, and if you notice, at the very beginning of Obama's speech, what he said about Medicare, he did, in fact, address things, and he used the phrase, Americans expect us to do reasonable compromise. And one of the things he mentioned there was, in fact, entitlement reform, and he specifically mentioned Medicare. And, you know, so there's, you know, he thinks, I don't think he really thinks that he's going to work bipartisanly with members of Congress at this point. But again, he knows the American public likes to hear that, and so he puts that in there. Now, Medicare is one of those things that, you know, everyone agrees almost that there have to be some kind of changes to it. They just disagree on what those changes are. Social Security is another good example of this in terms of does it just need a tweak or does it need fundamental reformation? And that's what politicians really disagree on. And so, you know, there was some talk of entitlement reform in Obama's speech, but it wasn't certainly at the center of it. But he did ask for bipartisanship on that.
Stefan, I have to leave it there. I'd like to have a response from you, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for being with us today. Donna Hoffman at UNI, Stefan Schmidt at Iowa State University.
Thanks, Dean. Thanks, Stefan.
Bye-bye.
River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, and we thank Catherine for this treasure of audio cuts today. Technical support from Dennis Reese and Jason Burns and Tony Daner. I'm Dean Borg, and River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio News.